I'm interviewing Dr. Toby Hance today about his World War II and other military experiences. And I live in Eden, North Carolina, 545 Southwood Drive. My telephone number is 623-7787. And Dr. Hance, would you identify yourself?
My name is LaConla Henson Hance, nicknamed Toby. This is August 6, 1997. I was born and raised in Lancaster, South Carolina. My date of birth was May 9, 1923. And I lived in Lancaster until I went to Clemson as a student in 1940. My current address is 319 Pinewood Place, Eden, North Carolina, 27288. And my telephone number is 910-623-8177.
And when you entered service, Toby, what was your address at that time?
I first enlisted at Clemson, South Carolina, in the Enlisted Reserve Corps when I had completed 2 years as a student at the Military College at Clemson.
And what was your branch of service and assignment, and why did you choose your particular branch of service over any others?
I had completed 2 years of ROTC training in the infantry while at Clemson during my first 2 years as a student. The infantry was the only branch of service being offered in ROTC at Clemson. As you probably know, the ROTC is suspended during wartime, and I enlisted in September of 1942, after the war had already started with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The students at Clemson who had completed 2 years in the ROTC were told that if they would join the Enlisted Reserve Corps, they would be permitted to stay in college until they graduated, at which time they would get a commission in the infantry, period. The acceleration of the war was such during the period September 1942 to June of 1943 that the Army had to change its regulations, and all of those in the Enlisted Reserve Corps were called to active duty in June of 1943 at the completion of our third year in college. The ones at Clemson were assigned to Fort Jackson in Columbia, South Carolina, where we were inducted as privates and issued our various equipment. I was then assigned to, I can't think of the name now.
We'll fill in the blank later.
Camp Blank at Spartanburg, South Carolina. Where I was in a company consisting entirely of enlisted Reserve Corps personnel from various colleges on the East Coast. We were required to complete the normal basic training for an infantry soldier for 17 weeks. At the end of this period, we were told that we would be going to OCS in Georgia as corporals and would be permitted to enter the officer candidate school at Fort Benning. Period. There was such a backup of personnel because of the calling of all the college students at the end of their third year that it was necessary for us to take a delay en route until some of those at Fort Benning could be graduated, period. Most of the people in my company were sent to Clemson for a 2-month period, during which time we were permitted to take some courses and get credit for them toward our degrees. By so doing, it was possible for me to return after the war and complete all of my requirements for graduation in 2 summer sessions, period.
Excuse me, what was your age then, Toby? I could figure it out, but when you entered the service, it was 1942.
When I enlisted, I was 19.
19.
And when I was called to active duty, I was 20.
So where did you take basic training then? Camp Croft, right, okay, that was a blank, right.
In Spartanburg, South Carolina.
And what type of training did you receive there?
The normal basic training for an infantry private.
And that would include?
All kinds of drills, marches.
Marksmanship?
Marksmanship, everything that you would expect to get at a basic training.
Okay, including bayonet drills and all the rest of it?
Yes.
Did you feel that the training you received was practical and adequate?
Yes, and particularly since I had already received most of this training when I was an ROTC student at Clemson.
Mm-hmm. Did you volunteer for any specialized or hazardous duty training at all?
No.
Where were you stationed after you completed your training?
And I went to Clemson, and then I went to Fort Benning to OCS, and I was there for 17 weeks.
17 weeks at OCS, and then at the conclusion of that 17 weeks, you?
I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the infantry in June of 1944.
And then where were you stationed?
And I was sent to Camp Shelby in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, to join the 65th Division.
65th Division. And how long were you in Camp Shelby?
I stayed in Camp Shelby from June of 1944 to January of 1945.
And on the weapons that you were trained on, what was your opinion of your primary weapons? I guess it was M1, I suppose, huh?
The M1 carbine. I was trained in machine guns, cannon, all that you would find in an infantry regiment.
Mm-hmm. And what types of uniforms did you wear while you were stateside?
Well, as a private, I wore the typical khakis and ODs, and when I became an officer, I had additional clothing issued, additional clothing, which I purchased for tropical worsted uniforms in khakis and ODs.
Were those uniforms something that you, you know, were comfortable wearing? Were they uncomfortable or too hot, too cold, whatever?
They were fine.
Fine. And how about the supply system for providing you with your uniforms and whatever else you needed? Did you find that you were able to get what you required to do your job easily?
Yes.
How about the food? What kind of food were you eating at this while you were still an enlisted man and then after you were an officer?
The food that I received in the service was always good.
Did they have any particular type of food that you enjoyed, or was it just kind of run of the mill, or was it?
It was adequate, and I have no recollection of when I was stateside of ever being hungry in any way. Uh-huh.
Did you have any emergency rations that you had to eat when you're out of maneuvers or anything of that nature?
Yeah, we had C rations on maneuvers.
And what was a C ration like?
C ration came in cans, which you usually would heat and open and eat from. Typical was pork and beans.
No fruit or vegetables particularly?
No.
Oh, man. Did you have any other kind of rations?
Well, after I went overseas, I had all kinds of rations. K rations and D rations.
T rations.
K.
Oh, K rations. Okay. K rations.
And these were also adequate. I have no complaint about them. I didn't always have time to eat much once we were in combat.
I'll bet.
And I lost a lot of weight.
I guess you'd lose weight anyway on these rations, would you not? Not too many calories.
I don't know that that was necessary. I just wish didn't, the pace was such that you tended not to
didn't worry about
worry about eating or gaining weight or losing weight.
Just trying to keep
But the day the war ended in Europe, where I served, I weighed 128 pounds. And I had on two suits of ODs and long underwear. And my normal weight would have been about 155.
Ooh, you lost some weight, all right. How about a question about your leadership, those folks that you reported to? Did you find anything particularly good or bad, or have any comments about those individuals?
In my basic training, we were led by officers and enlisted men who had had limited service up until that time because of the war. And most of them were so-called 90-day wonders. Many of the officers had been commissioned directly from civilian life with a limited training. That was not true when I got to Fort Benning, Georgia, where we had outstanding leaders and teachers. And in fact, I thought Benning was the best prepared place to go to school that I have ever been to.
Do you remember any specific examples or specific people that kind of are in your memory that you were involved with at that time? You know, that were folks that you looked to for leadership? Anybody in particular?
No.
This is a question that talks in terms of, I guess when you got overseas, terms of fragging, which is described the intentional injury and killing of a leader.
I never saw anything of that nature.
Was there any perception of difference on the part of those that were commissioned by a service academy versus the, you kind of answered this, versus the OCS or what have you, 90-day wonders? Kind of comment on that.
among the officer corps, there were people who were people who had become officers by working their way up through the ranks. There were people who had come from the academies. There were people who had come from ROTC. And there were many like myself who came through both the enlisted reserve and the ROTC. I would say the only discretionary thing, no, the only the only differences I saw was that we were reminded at times that that people who were from the academies were supposed to have the first opportunity to be promoted over those that weren't from the academy.
There's a term called ring knockers. Did any of did that ever
no I
mean
didn't.
From the academy?
In a particular company I served in after the war ceased, I do know that there was a case in which the academy officer received his promotion one day before the others, deliberately.
Outranked him, yeah, about one day. How about your discipline in your unit or common infractions and how they were punished? Anything on that you recall?
I don't recall there being much in the way of unusual discipline required.
Was there a difference in the behavior of the members of your unit in combat versus while you're still maybe stateside or in a safe part of the Europe?
Rarely. We did have one officer who was very gung-ho militarily in the States, and when he got overseas and into combat, he apparently had some kind of problem, and he psychologically was not worth going into combat with. He was afraid, and ultimately he had to be sent back to the rear lines.
Were drinking or drugs or gambling a problem?
No.
Or was there much gambling going on? You see it in the movies, you know, all the gambling.
No, not really.
You didn't really see it that much.
I saw it on the ship going overseas, but very little, if any, after that. And I never saw people drinking so much that it was a problem till after the war. And then I saw some people who drank as much as they could get.
Was going AWOL or desertion a problem or anything? You have any experience with that or any knowledge of that?
Not really. In the units I served with, the people were unusually dedicated to the job at hand.
Was there any type of discrimination prevalent that you observed?
There was a black battalion in one of the groups that I served. I mean, a black company that was attached to one of the battalions, and they were kept separate. It didn't enter my head as a problem. At the time, they were very loyal and worked very hard, and no one particularly noticed that they were not regular troops.
Was there any discrimination based on branch of service? Were you with any Marines or anything like that? Any difference between any of those folks that you noticed any discrimination? How did you spend your spare time, if you had any? I guess this would primarily be over in Houston. You didn't have any spare time particularly.
Well, in Europe, and when I was in Europe and the war was over, most of the duties were related to guarding prisoners of war, because we captured a large number and they were put in a fort, and it was our responsibility to furnish guard duty for those people. And so we did have times when we had time off. I was stationed in Ingolstadt, Germany after the war, where there were division headquarters, regimental headquarters, battalion headquarters, and company headquarters.
Right.
And so, and a nurses detachment. Therefore, we had a lot of, the infantry had a lot of work to perform, and we were not allowed to do anything because of that. It took first priority. Many officers were going back into France to help various industries get started. I applied for that as a textile person, and was told that I couldn't go because of the emergency needs of our own group. So it was a very busy time. I did have time in the late evenings sometimes to go horseback riding. I did on one occasion take a 1 week trip to Switzerland that the Army was sponsoring. And when the wintertime came, it wasn't possible to go skiing in the area of Ingolstadt.
Did you ever, or were there any rules or regulations about fraternization with the Germans from your day? Did you ever fraternize, not fraternize, but meet Germans, your former enemies? And
when the war ended, I was stationed in Austria. And at that time, there was a non-fraternization rule that lasted for about a month. Thereafter, there was no such thing as a fraternization rule, and it became possible for us to meet the Austrians and to know some of them in the little town where I was stationed. When I went back into Germany, in Ingolstadt, that was also possible. I knew some of the people who ran the coffee shop for the army, and the people who took care of the horses where I went horseback riding. And also some of those people were talented people who were without means to support themselves. And I particularly remember that one of them was the former director of the Nuremberg Opera, and he gave singing lessons to those who were willing to come and would pay him in candy bars and food. And I took advantage of that.
Did any of you people that you knew at that time fraternize with the young ladies and maybe eventually marry them and this kind of thing?
That happened in Austria when it was made possible, and I told about it the other Sunday.
Yeah, that happened. So a friend of yours.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell that story just briefly?
Well, one of the places that was in our zone in Austria after the war ended contained a castle, and one of the officers who went to the castle to see who was there and found a woman and her daughter. They were of royalty, and he became quite smitten with the young girl. But because of fraternization, he was not supposed to say anything to her or woo her in any way. I don't think it stopped him, but he went back several times. And when fraternization ended, he put forth his request that he be permitted to marry the girl, which he did.
And that was approved without any problem, I take it, then, at that point, after the fraternization?
Well, it wasn't highly encouraged, but they did approve it.
But they did approve it. How about the Red Cross, or the USO, or the YMCA, or any of those organizations? Do you have any relationship with those organizations while you were overseas? Anything they did for you, or?
Well, mainly I was related to the USO after the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
They put on various kinds of entertainment I once went from Ingolstadt to Munich, Germany, to see Bob Hope and his troupe as they were giving a concert. And Francis Langford was among them. The USO also sponsored a camp down at Garmisch, where soldiers could go on the weekends and enjoy the skiing and various winter activities that were there. And I was related to the USO there.
From the time that you got to Europe to the time the war was over, what period of time was that, Toby? When did you?
I landed in France in January of 1945. And I left Europe to come home in February of 1946. So I was there a little over a year.
How well did you and your fellow service members get along with the civilians while in the U.S. and while you were overseas?
Quite well, as far as I know.
And overseas?
No problem.
Did you have any occasion to, while you were guarding the prisoners, did you have any occasion to, not fraternize, but speak to them and I guess most of them didn't speak English, I suppose, did they? So you wouldn't have time or the ability to do that.
As an officer, I was not really required to do that duty. I set up plans for other people, but I did not personally have to stand guard.
Did you have to interact with maybe the officers that were captured and in any kind of a relationship?
No.
There? No.
I did. However, when the war ended, we met the Russians at the Inn River in Austria. Mm-hmm. And many of the people who were in these prison of war camps were trying to escape from the Russians, and therefore we were overly burdened with those people, thousands. The Russians, however, had reason to want a great many of those people, considering them to be almost
slaves.
No, traitors.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And so, some of the funny experiences were in dealing with the Russians. As we met them, and they came as part of their, like the CIA or OSS, who wanted to go into these prison camps and interview the Germans and try to find people among them who should be sent back into the Russian area because they had been traitors.
They were actually, how were they traitors? I'm not sure.
Well, they had been people who had committed war crimes against some of the Russians.
Okay.
And had escaped along with the Germans. Uh-huh. When they heard the Russians were coming.
Yes.
And the funniest of all these experiences that I had then was that an officer from their group could not be allowed to come and go into the prison of war camps without an officer from our group.
One of the Russians could not go in?
Right. And so I went with one or two of them. And their first objective was to find some kind of alcohol. We had to provide them with whatever they could. Because that was the number one objective. The second one is to interview these people.
Alcohol was number one.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to talk about with the Russians that might be of interest?
I was surprised at the Russian officers in the infantry whom we met, because they were seemingly people who had come up through the ranks rather than people who had been appointed or who went to school to get commissions. They were largely sort of country soldiers. In fact, one of them, who was a company commander, whom I met as we met the Russians, had never used a camera. And he had found one and wanted us to take his picture for him to send home. That was surprising.
Yeah, I would say. Prior to entering the service, what did you know about the general war situation, and what was it like when you heard about what was going on overseas as a young student and as a young enlistee there? What were your thoughts about that?
Since I was going to a military college, I think we were kept very well informed on what was happening in the world. You see, I was in college on the day of Pearl Harbor, and I was in the military system, so we were never without a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. And tell me again, when did you arrive overseas and how did you get there? I assume you went by ship.
From Hattiesburg, Mississippi to New York, we traveled by train, and then we boarded a ship, a Liberty ship, and went to Le Havre, France. Took 12 days, and we encountered at least one fleet of enemy vessels during that trip. It was called the Southern Trip because instead of going into the northern part of the ocean, we went to the southern part and swung back up into Le Havre. From Le Havre, we traveled with our normal supply of trucks and so forth to front lines, and there in our company vehicles.
How were the conditions aboard ship? I assume very crowded and so forth.
Well, as an officer, they were okay for me. For enlisted men, I would say that I did not like the quarters they had, and neither did most of them. They were jam-packed in the bottom of the boat.
And your
we were all seasick.
And while you were crossing, did you you say you there was an enemy?
We did encounter some enemy vessels, and
how did you react? What did
well,
you?
Well, we had a fleet of
destroyers
accompanying our group.
Any firing?
Yes, there were the dropping of depth charges.
Oh, there were submarines.
Yeah,
oh.
There were submarines involved in it. Mm. But with the fleet that was guarding us as we went across, they managed to maneuver around these. The enemy chased them away. Huh. So there were no lives lost during it.
So you arrived at Le Havre, is that correct?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And at that point, where your unit was, that you were going to, was located where then?
Okay, when we landed in Le Havre in January of 1946. 45. They had already been a D-Day. They were already, the troops had advanced all the way up to the margin of line. Mm. And at that point, there was a stalemate, and so our group was put into what was called tactical reserve. We were sent to a big staging area called Camp Lucky Strike at Le Havre, which was made up of big open fields with approximately 12 inches of snow, and tents had been pitched on top of those in arrangement in companies and battalions, where we were to exist until we were called up from active into active participation. We stayed there 6 weeks. We had to learn to live on 2 meals a day. One at 10.
Are these rations now, like yeah. C rations, K rations?
Whatever. No. Well, the food that was available, there were so many troops overseas by then that we were limited to normal rations of a breakfast at about 10 to 11 in the morning. And
did you go through a mess hall and this
yeah,
kind of thing?
Yeah.
The typical.
Yeah.
Type thing.
And to a dinner at about 4:30.
Mm-hmm. And how was that food? Just that was it adequate or?
Well, it was okay. We could live with it. You learn to get used to it.
Anything in particular about that food there that was, you know, like did you get served a lot of the same stuff over
yes.
and over and over again? This
yes.
kind of.
They were short of coffee, so we had to learn to drink hot tea. Things of that nature.
Was there a particular meal that they served over and over again that you
no,
got sick of?
I don't remember that.
Yeah. Okay. Did you get any additional training after you arrived overseas? Did they kind of waiting more or less?
Well, in this strategic reserve thing, we were briefed on what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
We had some training films. We were active daily, but not in any major way to get further training.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after that 6 weeks, what?
We were then committed to action in the southeastern part of France. Along the Saar River.
And what division was this then?
I was in the 65th Division. It was committed as a part of Patton's Third Army.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And to the north of us was Montgomery with his troops, all of which were just moving beyond the Maginot Line and toward Germany. They had been stalemated there for weeks. And once our troops were committed, we began the process of moving across the Saar River and into Germany.
Did you have any knowledge of the reputations of Montgomery? And you know, you hear a lot about Eisenhower and Montgomery and Patton and Montgomery. Did that filter down to?
A little, but. In general, we weren't near enough, it didn't seem to be near enough to them to have any concerns about them. Being in Patton's army was an interesting experience.
How so?
And I did have the occasion to meet General Patton. He came to the front lines where our troops were, mm-hmm. and just as we were preparing to enter Austria. Came to the front lines to inspect them.
What time frame was this in?
This is much later.
This is before the war was over, obviously.
Yeah. Probably this would have been about in April of that year.
Okay.
You may recall that once we got across the Saar River and into Germany, there was a rapid movement of troops headed toward Berlin.
We wanted to get there first.
And to and toward the Rhine River and Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
The troops I was with were moving so fast that we had to have trucks to move us from one spot to another.
The Germans were retreating that fast?
Yes, yes, once we crossed into Germany.
I mean, how close were you to the retreating Germans at that point? Were they just running hightail?
Well, you have to understand Patton's approach. Patton would keep two units on his front line moving in the direction been told to move.
Mm-hmm.
In between them, he would organize what was known as a combat team, and it would consist of infantrymen, artillerymen, all kind of branches, and he would put them onto trucks and put them down the main Autobahn and pass through the units that were on the front line, and they would be told to go until they were stopped. And they did. My units were like that, especially after we crossed the Rhine River. We were told to get on the Autobahn with this huge combat team. I mean, there were probably 500 vehicles.
So you did this?
Yes, and we were told, go to Berlin unless stopped. Those were the orders Patton gave.
So what happened?
We went about 25 miles and got stopped.
Now how did you get stopped?
The enemy had formed a line there and started fighting back as they were had been retreating. And therefore, at that point, Patton pulled another combat team and sent them south of there, and another combat team and sent them north of there to get behind them. And we stayed then to form the line, the new line. And the Germans were at that point counterattacking with everything they could. We stayed in that position about a week or two and were pulled out of there and sent not north toward Berlin, but we're told to go south, to go as far as Austria if we could. And that's what we did.
Did you notice that there was a shortage, you know, in your, when you were stopped by the enemy, the German, did you notice that there was any indication that they were conserving ammunition or anything of that kind, that they really couldn't fight the way that you previously had experienced?
Well, the next big thing that we did was when we were pulled back and told to go south, we were sent to cross the Danube at Regensburg.
Yes.
And at that crossing, this was a very large undertaking, and the Germans were well encamped on the other side, and they had plenty of ammunition. There was no conservation of anything. They were fighting madly.
Truth and man.
The strangest recollection I have in that period was that our units were pulled back into reserve on one occasion, and Patton's troops had reached some of the prisoner of war camps, the Jewish people had been held.
Oh yeah, the concentration camps.
Concentration camps. And Patton was so outraged that he made every company that was in a strategic reserve at that point come back to those camps and go see exactly what had happened.
And which one did you go through?
I have forgotten the exact name of it, but it was one of the big ones.
It wasn't Dachau, was it?
Dachau.
Was it Dachau?
Dachau.
That's one that we went.
He wanted to insist that we, every troop, every soldier saw it. And the only thing I can tell you is that I did say something just to show you. We found a photograph in one of those. And that's what it looked like.
Where did you find this photograph?
In one of the little villages where we were staying.
No kidding.
Near there.
I'm looking at a photograph here of hundreds of bodies.
Bodies.
This is a Dachau thing.
It was nearby. Taken
at nearby Dachau.
And that's something.
Yeah, really, that's beyond belief.
Well, when beyond they belief. Say today, some people say they didn't understand, they didn't believe those things took place. Patton wanted to be sure that they all knew.
Everybody knew.
And saw them. At Regensburg, there were also other camps, other types of concentration camps. There were large ovens built into the mountains. There's a mountain range along the river at Regensburg, the Danube River.
and they contained these huge ovens, and you could see them by riding along the road.
So when you were stationed on near the front lines, a part of this activity as one of the lead units against the enemy, what was your daily life like then? What did you, I guess you were doing a lot of marching and whatever.
Walking. But at that point, you see, there was so much retreat going on that you tended to be motorized instead of marching long distances. You probably were put onto trucks and moved up to a certain distance. And when you encountered the enemy again, the trucks unloaded and you began to form your front lines. Mm. To give you an example, then when we reached the ENN River, which enters Austria, separate.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
When you reach the river?
The Inn River, which separates Germany from Austria. We were told to hold up at that point, and we could see some troops cross, and that was when Patton came and said to view the front lines and said he wanted somebody across that river that morning. Mm-hmm. He didn't care how we got across, so we made floats and floated jeeps across.
How did you make floats? I mean,
cut down trees, wrapped them together, and made rafts.
No kidding.
And we got two jeeps across, and these jeeps started and went over into Austria, and they went about 20 miles before they found any troops. The troops had pulled back during this period.
So far.
And so Patton ordered the rest of the people to get across that river and to pursue them. We even went so far as to commandeer a school bus and put our soldiers on the school bus and take them this 20 miles to get up to the point where the Germans had formed the line. That's how rapid it was moving.
They were really moving, weren't they?
Yeah.
At this time, when you were doing this, what was your functional title, so to speak? Were you company commander or squad leader or whatever?
No, I was a battalion S3.
Battalion S3, what does that mean?
That's the operations officer. He's the one who is to prepare the plans for attack.
Oh, okay.
For three companies. A battalion is made up of three companies. And my job at that point in combat was to see to it that we had a plan for the attack, the plan and the orders for it, and the briefings were my responsibility.
Now, I'm going to ask this facetiously, but where was your office? I mean, I know you didn't have an office. What did you have? You operated with a notebook?
What you did was to form a command post, mm-hmm. and usually at that stage you would commandeer some house for it.
Oh, okay.
And set up in that house and then be prepared to move it instantly.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't necessarily a stable thing.
So how much did you have to move when you moved? How much paper and so file?
Oh, very little paper.
Just very little, huh?
Yeah.
A lot of this was really off the cuff planning, I assume, because you never knew what.
Well, you had maps and things of that nature, too. You had to take those with you. But it moved rather rapidly.
Yeah.
And in fact, you seldom would get to stay in one command post. After we crossed into Germany, you seldom got to stay in one command post more than overnight, one night.
Okay.
The next day you were moving. You had to keep up with the troops. You had to go see where they were. You had to make the plans for them. For on one occasion, I well remember that we had a coordinated attack planned for in the morning, let's say at 6:30, and two companies were involved to be online, and one of them was slow getting there. And it's my responsibility to go see where they were, be sure they got up there. And I went back and they were eating a hot meal back in the woods. The cook heard they were going into combat and he wanted to have something hot, so he served them pancakes and syrup. And that made them about 5 minutes late, so we had to coordinate the attack.
So you had a Jeep and a driver at your disposal, right, so you could do all these things, get around and see what was happening. Now you fought in World War II against, just in Europe against the Germans, so to speak. And what was your impression of the enemy's tactics and weapons and how they were organized and so forth?
Well, from what I had seen, they were very formidable. However, when we began to move rapidly, they began to deteriorate rapidly. And therefore, it was a sort of catch-as-catch-can, the whole thing.
What were the age of the prisoners that you caught?
Oh, they were all ages.
I mean, did you have children, really? 10-year-old? You
know, no.
Toward the end of the war, I understand that they...
We didn't. I didn't see any.
Didn't see any of that. Most of them were in their 20s or whatever.
Yeah, like 20s to 30s.
Okay. And you of course, you were involved in combat. I don't know if you were shooting your gun or whatever, or you were more or less directing the activities of others, but...
But even as such, you had to be...
You're right up there in the...
You had to be right up with
them. You were exposed, in other words, definitely. No. Do you have any feelings about how you felt, you know, in that exposed position and so forth?
You were young, and the adventurous spirit was there, and you didn't stop to think about what all could happen to you. You know, you just went, and you didn't worry about it.
Did it cross your mind was your feeling one of as you were doing this fighting one of patriot? Hey, I'm fighting for my country, or was it just kind of, hey, I'm here, I got to do a job, and I'm going to stay here until it's done?
Well, I always felt we were fighting for our country. We had a job to do, and we were to do it, and not sit around and complain about it and not worry about it. I had a lot of faith.
Right.
I felt the Lord was with us, and he would take care of us, and he did. There were times when you had to be alone. I'll tell you, one of the questions here is, did you ever get any medals? But when we first went into combat, I was an assistant S3 for a regiment, which is a higher up level. As such, I was detailed to be the liaison between a regiment and a division headquarters. And therefore, I had to travel by night with the driver in a Jeep. Between the two locations, they were often as much as 25 miles apart, in which you had to go on your own. And you hoped that there were no scouts or anything out from the enemy. But on one of these occasions, another liaison officer and myself were given the orders to take back to the regiments to coordinate a planned attack of the whole division. And for the next morning at 7 o'clock. And I started out at about midnight and went toward where my regimental command had been, but it had been gradually moving and it had been shifting south and east. And during that time, I had to pass through enemy territory. As dawn came, I was on a highway, and had to detour because a German battalion had been on that highway and had been strafed. And for miles, there was nothing but dead bodies and animals. They had a lot of horses and things, using a lot of horses at that point. I managed to get up with my regimental commander then about 6:45, and it just so happened that the adjoining regimental commander was at our command post coordinating with the colonel, and I was able to give him what the plan was for attacking that morning, the two regiments together. And the other liaison officer never made it to them. For that, I was awarded the Bronze Star. I didn't know it at the time. I mean, after the war's over, the colonel came and told me that's what he put in. But because of that, we were able to do the coordinated attack of the division along with other divisions on a broad line to go across the Saw River. But in that case, you see, you had to travel at night by yourself with a driver, and you had to be prepared to protect yourself.
Absolutely.
And you couldn't see anything, couldn't cut on any lights.
You're very exposed.
Yeah.
Very exposed. What was the overall morale of your unit, would you say? Was it good?
Well, ours had been a good one. We had trained together in the States, and once committed, I think they were all pretty high level. Most of them were people from the Southeast, the officers and the men, and they felt a real responsibility to do what they, we were one of the last divisions formed in the United States.
Did you have a lot of new men coming in then, or was it kind of a stable group?
Well, we didn't. As we lost men, we had new ones coming in, but we had gone overseas as a unit. Therefore, we knew each other a lot.
You had a lot of closeness among the among your group.
And we trained in the States together.
Was there any particular problem with, you know, mail, lack of mail, any grousing about pay or enemy propaganda?
We didn't have time for any of that.
Didn't have any time for it. Too busy protecting yourself, I'm sure.
I suppose after the war, we got more of those kinds of complaints because you had time to stop. And it's all right, now where's the mail? Here we let me explain to you that when we were in Austria and met the Russians, we stayed there for about 2 months. And during that time, they began to send some of the guys back home that became eligible for returning. And so much of my units, which was a young one, see, and not qualified to be going home early, were pulled back into the Army of Occupation. So we were sent from Austria back into Ingolstadt to another division. Our division was broken up overseas, and we filled in for those people who were leaving. And that's when we began this prisoner of war kind of guard duty as part of the Army of Occupation.
Did you work with any of our allies?
I worked with the Russians for about 2 months.
Yeah. I guess they were allies, turned into something else, but anyway. You were not a POW.
No.
You talked about your award. Where and how did you learn about the ceasefire, which was VE Day?
Okay, VE Day, we were in Austria. We were mostly performing this duty of rounding up the prisoners who were in that area who had retreated from the Russians and putting them into camps where we could keep up with them. A lot of them weren't even soldiers or anything. They were just people who were running away from the Russians. And we had to find some field that we could start a new camp in or something to get them oriented and looked after. At that particular time, I got a message on my radio saying to come to the command headquarters of our regiment. They had an important announcement to make. So we went back to the, we weren't fighting at that time. We'd met the Russians and it'd been a week or so in there of just sort of corralling everybody. And when we got back, the colonel announced to us that VE Day would be tomorrow or the next day. I think we were told on the 8th that I have never been sure just when it was. I think we were told on the 7th that it would be on the 8th. And it actually was put in the books as being on the 9th, which was my birthday, May the 9th.
Kind of skipped the question I wanted, but let me go back to Toby. The psychological stresses inherent in combat service, how did you and your people that you were with handle that?
For the most part, I thought they were real good. We had some unusual experiences, as I explained, this officer who had a problem. We had some others that were very moving. I had a friend who was with me in OCS, and he went to the same division I did, but a different company. He was a platoon leader in an infantry company. And when we crossed the Danube, he was out front, he and his men, and his company commander had gone ahead of them and moved up and was pinned down by fire and got hit about 20 yards out ahead of the troops. So this boy crawled out there and got him and pulled him back. And when they went to get him, he had 60 wooden bullets in his legs where they had shot. They were short of ammunition. They were using wooden bullets. And so he was recommended for the Congressional Medal of Honor. He didn't get it. He got a Silver Star. But the irony of it is that he was a little boy, young and small in stature, and was always trying to make himself look bigger than he was by wearing oversized clothes. He's very sensitive and was teased a lot. And yet he was the most courageous person in our unit. And I was always very proud that I knew him.
Yeah, I can see you would be.
He's still living, and I know that.
Had any contact with him?
Well, he was away when I went through Lexington, Kentucky, and he happened to have been a friend of the people we were staying with. But his wife had died, and he had remarried, and they had moved away on a trip. They were on a trip, but he still runs a horse farm.
Have you ever called him or anything, or
no,
talked to him?
No.
That would be quite a reunion.
Yeah.
To get back to him. The wooden bullets. Now this is news to me. I don't recall reading about that.
Well, apparently, at the end of the war, as the Germans got short of ammunition, they used unusual things like that, and one of them was wooden bullets.
That's amazing. That's news to me.
And Dunlap took a lot of those. They said 60. I don't know. I didn't see it. And but that they had an awful time getting them out. They would go in and splinter.
Oh, yeah. Be terrible. Another question, go back to something else. Were you exposed to any German propaganda by way of maybe on the radio with Axis Sally and you know, this kind of business?
No, we didn't have time to listen to that kind of mess.
And there, we didn't have any leaflets dropped on
it. If it was there, we didn't see any.
Yeah. Okay.
We really were part of a mopping up campaign.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In southern Germany and Austria.
How was it determined after VE Day? How was it determined who was allowed to come home and when?
Well, it's based upon service and how many years you'd been in and how many years you'd been overseas, and you've got a numbering system, and you could calculate up what your number was. And so when you had that, they start at the top, and those that had the most numbers or points were sent home as soon as they could arrange it. Then others became eligible. In my case, being one of the last units committed and formed, we didn't have much in the way of points. And so in February of 46, we were told that those who didn't have a lot of points could go home for a 6 weeks leave if they would agree to stay an additional year when they got back. And so I took advantage of that and came home for leave. And by the time I arrived at North Carolina. By the time I got to North Carolina, to the place I was supposed to go on leave from, they said that the rules had changed while I was en route, and that now I had enough points so that I couldn't be sent back overseas. So I got my leave and was then sent to Camp Anniston, Alabama, to a camp at the end of the 6 weeks leave. And when I got to that camp, they said they'd now reduced the number again, and I would be eligible in 1 week for discharge.
Oh boy.
So I served a week there and then got out.
The point system, was this a fair way to do things, do you think?
Yes.
And it was based on?
Service.
Over there?
How long you'd been in the service here and how long you'd been overseas.
How about combat? Did that make a difference?
Yeah, you got credit for that.
Extra credit.
Now, one of the things they did that probably did not seem exactly right to us at that time, some of the people who had never been overseas but were here in the States, and it cost very little to get rid of them, they got rid of them too. Just because you were overseas, you were penalized a little bit. That's the only discriminatory thing that I saw.
After you were released from active duty, did you have any obligation then to serve any further, or were you strictly?
Well, I was a reserve officer.
Okay, so
therefore, I had to. I think I had to. I'm not sure. I signed up for the reserve. I was a reserve officer for 5 years.
After
I got out.
After you got out. And then how about the GI Bill? Did that come into play then in your
case? Yes, it did, and I took advantage of it.
What did that mean to you, the GI Bill? And the,
well, in effect, I went to, I finished a summer of summer school, and I got out in April of 46. So I went back to Clemson in June of 46 and got two summer schools in. They were doing 6 weeks each. That I completed my degree then by September. The GI Bill paid for my tuition and my books, and also gave me some money to live on.
You recall how much that might have been?
$100 a month.
$100 a month. And that was almost enough, I guess, at that time, if you scrimped, huh?
So I wanted to then go on to graduate school, and the graduate school I wanted to go to was not going to open until September of 47. So I stayed at Clemson and taught a year through two semesters and two summer schools, waiting for that graduate school to open in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. And I went to Charlottesville to graduate school for 4 years under the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And again, they paid my tuition and fees and gave me $125 a month.
And basically that was sufficient for you to?
No, I got a scholarship too. Oh. It would have taken them extra.
Mm-hmm. To live and so forth.
Yeah. I got a scholarship of $100 a month. Mm-hmm. So between that and Chris's working, I was married.
Yeah.
And she taught school. We were able to survive. Yeah. Well, but I went to school under the GI Bill for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the Hollywood movies and so forth that have been made about World War II? Do you think they were accurate, or for the most part, or do you have any comment?
Well, I think that almost all of them could have happened exactly as they show them. They might have condensed them together rather than showing these periods in which everything was stalemated.
Do you have a particular favorite movie of that era that kind of rings bells with you?
No, not particularly.
Do you have any other particularly humorous or sad incidents from your time of service that you recall? You've already mentioned a couple. Anything that was funny, particularly? We've heard about a sad one.
Well, one of the sad ones to me was that one of our units in this moving forward rapidly until stopped idea we had two companies that had moved forward and had them on a line, and they came to a village area. And so they took over the village, and we're going to sort of get a good night's sleep. They were to hold up at that point. And the battalion commander and all of its people are settled in various houses, you know, and going to spend the night. During the night, the Germans counterattacked with a lot of tanks that had been on our flank, and so we were a little bit exposed at that, so that during the night these tanks came into the town, and the townspeople pointed to where the command posts were. Mm-hmm. They stuck these cannons from the tanks into the windows and blasted. And the rest of the troops, you know, got together and started moving against these tanks, and the tanks pulled back out. The unit I was with then moved on in. When we did, I was so distressed. It had rained, but the water that was flowing in the gutters and the little village and everything was blood red. Mm-hmm. That was a horrible experience.
You don't recall the name of the town, by
no, I don't. I can look it up probably. But in that next night, then we moved on through and into the next little village and set up headquarters. We had the field artillery and all with us, and there was a man there who was the spotter for the field artillery. And he spent the night in the same little room that I did. We were all you had bedrolls and everything, you were lying on the floor. But all during the night, we would hear the shells going out or coming in. And every time one would whiz over, he would say, "Is that coming in or going out?" So I didn't sleep a wink. For listening to answer his question.
Could you tell?
In general, you could. the whistle was a little different. Most of it was they were going out. Yeah. They were beating these
every
people
time
back.
The whistle would make you kind of give you a start.
Another one I remember is after the war, they let some of the troops go back into on leave for like a week, you know, go back into Paris. And on one such occasion, this officer took some of his men and he was going back in. They were teasing him that they wanted him to go up and date, ask one of these girls in Paris for a date, you know. And he said, okay, the first one they saw who had green hair, he'd go up and ask. And so they got off the train and started in through the station and met a mulatta who had green hair. And they made him eat his word. He had to go ask her for a date. She didn't give it to him. But I always thought it was one of the funniest stories I heard.
Actually had green hair.
He thought he was perfectly safe, you know.
That's
and the other funny one I heard of was that I had a friend later after the war who had been stationed there in Paris. She was with the military. She was WAC. And an officer, and I asked her if she dated the other officers, and she said yes, and she went rather steady with one of them, but she never married, but she went real steady with this fellow, and she was in love with him until Christmas time, and he gave her a tie for Christmas. She said that ended it. And I had to have a middle picture of you give a girl a tie.
Today it might work. You mentioned you met Patton and you saw Bob Hope. Any other famous people that you served with or met or anything?
No, not really. Well, all the people who were with Bob Hope.
Bob Hope, yeah.
Jerry Colonna,
yeah.
And Francis Langford. And Bob Hope.
Did they give you a chance to meet any of these people, or was it all arms?
You've seen the pictures of them, yeah. All the GIs out here.
Yeah.
They would go to what we call today a coliseum, a stadium or something, yeah. And they set up their stage in the one end of it, and then all the troops and all would file in and sit in each other's laps almost to get to see them. But they had good speaker systems. And
How appreciated was that?
Oh, very much. They the troops loved it.
I bet they did. Overall, how would you characterize your military service?
Well, I was very proud of my service in the military and appreciated it. I think it did a lot for me personally. I learned a lot about teaching techniques, especially the CS, I thought. And I had a lot of pride about my country and the people that worked in it. I couldn't imagine the kind of things we heard and saw later on, you know, and the Vietnamese War and all that. I knew no attitudes like that at all.
Do you have anything that you would consider to be your most interesting or important single experience while in the service? Anything that kind of jumps out?
Well, I think I've mentioned most of them already.
Have you been back to any places where you've served in the past, you know, on vacation?
I've traveled in Germany a lot.
Have you been back to any specific place where you recall having been?
Well, they've all changed so now. See, they were very down, torn up,
yeah.
When I was there, and now you can't see that in Munich. Right after the war, I went to Birch's Garden, to the Eagle's Nest like you did. But I would say the German people have come so far that there's nothing like it was when I was there to recognize. I didn't go back for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I haven't seen anything in my travels back that reminded me at all.
Did you go through the same location?
I went through Ingolstadt. Spent a good bit of time in the Munich and Ingolstadt, mm-hmm. and Frankfurt areas.
Mm-hmm. But everything was so changed, you couldn't.
Yes, it's like a tourist area now.
Yeah, can't recognize.
When you went to Salzburg, if you went by, did you go by car down through the main Autobahn going into Austria?
We went from Grodig into Salzburg, you know, that restaurant and so forth you mentioned.
Well, during
the war. It was a main road from Berchtesgaden to Salzburg, though.
All right, during the war, right after the war, we were in Ingolstadt now, back in the Army of Occupation, the 9th Division. And my commander wanted to go through back into Austria to visit the place where we were when the war ended. And so we got a Jeep and we started down that same Autobahn that goes right by Kimsey, and went right on into Salzburg and had dinner there. And we were so impressed to see, because by then the hotels were operating now and the army had taken them over. And we were able to have dinner in this hotel, and the waiters were playing violins, and we could get over the changes that had occurred.
Yeah, I would say.
An interesting experience. When I came back into the Army of Occupation in the 9th Division, the particular regiment I was assigned to in Ingolstadt was headed by a colonel who was at that time said to be the youngest full colonel in the infantry. And he was from South Carolina. And so I met him, and we were there in the same town. And since I was from South Carolina, I knew who he was, and he knew who I was. And when I was able to go home on that 6 weeks leave, I worried, you know, that they would be expecting me to come back, and I sent a telegram back to the regiment to explain what had happened and that I wouldn't be coming back. And don't you know, one stop a minute. I sent the telegram to inform them of what had happened, and I went to get a job because I couldn't go back to school for 2 months. And one day we were staying at Chris's family's house. And so one day I came home for lunch, and there sitting on the porch was my regimental commander. He had gotten sent home also.
Did you like the drink?
No. He had been sent home in the meantime, and he heard about this. So he was passing near there and decided he'd come by and speak. And it was General Westmoreland. He later became the general, and he later became... He was my regimental commander.
You didn't mention that. Now, very interesting one.
Yeah, I said that would be interesting too.
That would be most interesting.
Well, Westmoreland was the youngest full colonel in the infantry at that time.
That's very interesting.
And shortly after he was on the porch there talking with us, he went on to Fort Bragg, and he married the daughter of a general there, and then he became a general.
Yeah.
And then later he went on to Washington. And
so did you ever have any contact with him after that particular?
I never have. I've tried. I've missed him.
Mm-hmm.
He's now living in Charleston. And I went by his house, and he was away. No one was home. But the strange thing about it, he was originally from Pacolet, South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
which is just outside of Spartanburg. And he went to school in Spartanburg with Collie's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so Collie knew him too, growing up in Spartanburg. And so Collie and I both went to speak to him. He was a very good friend of Collie's brother.
Yeah. Well, he's a historical figure, no question about that.
Well, he wasn't historical at that time.
He sure is now.
He got loaded with a lot of things later on.
Yeah, he suffered a bad.
He was such a military man that whenever he stood anywhere, he always stood at parade rest. So much so that he had developed a little niche in the back below the waist where his hands fit. And we always remember to say that he was the most military-bearing person we'd ever met.
Toby has a little publication here outlining where his 65th Division was stationed during the war, and you can just maybe just tell us where it went from where to where.
We landed in La Hara and was stationed at Camp Lucky Strike in Strategic Reserve for 6 weeks. We were then committed in the vicinity of Sour Lawton, which is on the Saw River. It was near the Siegfried Line, and we then breached that line into Germany. The breaching of that line in that area is the same drive that I spoke of in getting the bronze medal, that we went through this. And as you see, we went north eastward then to the Rhine River. And just on the other side of it, we crossed the Rhine River at Remagen and went about 20 miles. And then we were pulled back south and headed towards Austria, where we crossed the Danube, and then we crossed into...
Or was that at, what city was that?
That's Regensburg.
Regensburg, okay.
Uh-huh. And then we went on through Austria.
Through Plattling, is that it?
Uh-huh.
Plattling?
Mm-hmm. And we went through Linz, Austria, which was the second largest city and was the munitions city,
mm-hmm.
on to ENNS.
Enns. Huh?
And that's where we met the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
There are two Enns rivers in Austria. One of them is INNS. That separates the two countries. And ENSS is where we met the Russians. And later, this division was deactivated in this area, and most of them sent back into the 9th Division, located at Ingolstadt.
And that's where you went. Okay. Very interesting. That concludes the interview, unless you have something else you want to add, Toby?